undergraduate work is Oxford. His PhD was in physics at Cambridge with Steve Bell. And then he's a junior research fellow at Wolfson College. One of the coolest colleges in Cambridge. Before he joined PI, it's the first Oxford.
Thanks very much, Adrian. Crowley's PhD thesis describing Crowley's idea of the wave-particle duality. It's reported that he commented that de Broglie had lifted the edge of a great veil. And in the several years immediately following that, the quantum formalism achieved the form that we have today. And in the 80 years since then, it's proven to be an extraordinarily flexible theoretical framework and proven to be empirically highly successful. But we still find it mysterious. And so the question is, why do we find it mysterious after all of this time? And I think to address a question like that, it's actually very useful to back off and actually look at something that we say that we do understand relatively well, mainly classical physics. Classical physics has a threefold structure. At the heart of it is a conception of reality, the mechanical view of reality. And that comes with a lot of assumptions about how what is the nature of the physical world. And when these are mathematized in some fairly natural way, they give rise to the classical mathematical framework. And then specific physical theories like Newtonian mechanics or electromagnetism or thermodynamics are built up within that framework. The mechanical conception is essentially that the universe is a vast machine, and it's quantitatively describable. The totality of the state of a system can be perfectly described quantitatively, and it changes in step with universal time according to laws of motion, which are eternal and apply equally in all places. And not only that, but this universe is sort of accessible to mortals who have only limited access to limited parts of the universe. So the idea is that, in principle, it's possible for us to study isolated or quasi-isolated parts of the universe, perform measurements on those, which in principle give us complete knowledge of the states of those systems, and can do so, in principle, without creating any disturbance. When these ideas are formalized, we get the familiar mathematical framework of classical physics, with the idea of the state space representing the set of all possible physical states of the system, and then dynamics represented by one-to-one maps of the state space, and then measurements represented by maps from the state space to the real numbers. And then when you formulate specific physical theories, such as Newtonian mechanics, introducing additional structure. In the case of Newtonian mechanics, obviously, the idea of space as the canvas or stage where everything happens is the crucial idea. So what is the situation with quantum theory? Well, at the top here, there's Schrödinger's mechanics, which is the direct counterpart of Newtonian physics. And then the quantum mathematical framework, I mean by that the von Neumann-Dirac formalism, which one can regard as an abstraction from the mechanics of Schrödinger and Heisenberg. And at the bottom, we have a gap. We have no conception of reality, which ties together all of the physical and mathematical assumptions that underlie this quantum mathematical framework. And this is perhaps one of the fundamental problems. Whereas in the case of classical physics, we have a single conception of reality, which somehow allows us to understand or accept most of the assumptions underlying classical physics. We have nothing like that in the case of quantum theory. I think a lot of the difficulties arise, or can be seen to arise, because of the process by which quantum theory was arrived at historically. In the case of Schrödinger's mechanics, which started fairly innocently as the attempt to mathematically formalize de Broglie's wave-particle duality in the form of a wave equation, In the process of trying to do that, many elements were introduced, physical ideas, mathematical ideas, which were really very foreign to the classical framework. For example, the wave that he introduced wasn't something that we could directly access, but something that we could access once removed. And so via Born's statistical interpretation. And then complementarity, the idea within the framework of this mechanics that when you perform, say, position measurements on the system, performing subsequent position measurements provides no new information about the state of the system. So one is fundamentally restricted for some reason as to how much information we can gain about the state of the system. And this complementarity is very important because it means that the choice of the experimenter as to which experiment she decides to do is actually of fundamental importance. Because in classical physics, in principle, there's one complete measurement which just tells you what the state of the system is. But in quantum physics, if we're restricting ourselves to von Neumann measurements, the choice of the experimenter is of fundamental importance. And then the fact that, as I've mentioned with this Schrödinger's wave, this is not a wave that can be thought of as living in ordinary three-dimensional space. It lives in some more abstract space. This becomes obvious when you consider two particles and so on. And perhaps one of the most puzzling features is that Schrödinger's mechanics presupposes the existence of the classical world of definiteness in its very formulation. And this comes out in two respects. First of all, most obviously through measurement. Measurement is taken as a primitive in that framework. And the outcomes of measurements are described classically and conceived classically. The framework makes no sense unless you know what physical process you should treat as a measurement and what you should treat from using the Schrödinger equation itself. And it also comes in because if you have, say, an electron in an electromagnetic field, you're treating the electron using Schrödinger's equation and then the electromagnetic field using Maxwell's equation. So you're making a cut between the system that you're going to treat quantum mechanically and the environment. And even if you say, well, we quantize the electromagnetic field, well, then still your quantum system is living in classical space-time. So what about that? So that's very troubling. And then finally, at the mathematical level, the Schrödinger equation, the Schrödinger mechanics, introduces complex numbers in a fundamental way. And that's not so clear at all why that should be the case. And the Born rule, this link between the wave function and the probability density function over positional momentum, the mathematical form of that was essentially argued on heuristic grounds by Born. And so we lack a clear understanding of what physics really lies behind it. All of these difficulties carry straight through to the von Neumann Dirac formalism and some more. In the case of the von Neumann formalism, the state of a system can be in a finite dimensional complex vector space. So measurements, outcomes, can be finite in number for particular physical systems and particular measurements, which is something, again, which we don't see in classical physics. So just to summarize the differences, in the classical framework, the idea is that we can conceive of the universe as a whole. And when we zoom in and focus on particular systems, that's for our convenience. And there's no fundamental meaning to the cuts that we make when we choose to describe a system as such and the environment as something else and the measurement apparatus as something else. But in quantum theory, we can't even begin to do any kind of calculation unless we make those cuts. And where we make those cuts is of real significance. It really changes the predictions that we would get. And a great deal of effort has been put into trying to understand the reason for this cut. I mean, does it have to be made? Bohr famously argued that it was actually necessary for any physical theory that it have measurement as part of its vocabulary. And so he's thought of it as something necessary. But there are other points of view. And one point of view in the many worlds picture, you try to dispense of the idea of measurement as a primitive entirely. Another attempt is to try and modify the quantum formalism so that collapse happens as part of the natural dynamics of the system. So you're really modifying then the idea of unitary evolution itself. And then there are other important issues like the probabilistic nature of measurement outcomes. Again, one can take different positions on that, and people have done and explored their consequences. One is to take it as a primitive, as a given. And the other is to say that actually there is a deterministic world which underpins the probabilistic nature of measurements. And there are hidden variables, there are uncontrollable variables which are responsible for why we actually are only able to predict things probabilistically. In addition to these physical differences between the classical framework and the quantum framework, there are all these mathematical, there's all this mathematical structure that the quantum formalism presupposes. And it's a much richer mathematical structure than anything we find in the classical framework. I mean, the classical framework is very austere. It just talks about states being represented by sets of real numbers and dynamics being one-to-one maps and so on. These are very weak assumptions. But in the quantum framework, very strong assumptions are made about the kind of mathematical structure that we need. And one of the questions that's been asked a great deal in quantum foundations recently is are there physical principles that lie behind this mathematical structure?
Can I ask a question? Why do you find real numbers less mysterious than complex numbers? I think real numbers are very, very sophisticated objects in mathematics, right? Well, we can just measure only finite amount of time, a finite number of times in a person's lifetime, right? So for example, I think even introducing a continuous thing, which is real number, is a very huge jump from a primitive, well, naive way of observation. So, and once you introduce real number, then a jump from real number to complex number is just a, well, twofold increase in complexity, right? So I don't know why. Could you explain why you think classical mechanics are easier to understand than quantum mechanics?
It's really a matter of, I mean, of course you can question this assumption itself. Ah. Sure. But what I'm doing here is really to make a comparison, almost using this as a benchmark, as a reference point, to say, well, in addition to this structure, in a quantum framework, there's much more structure there. Okay. I mean, there's different ways of seeing this. One way, which is, I think, very nice, if you take the complex spectrum n dimensions, and you simply write it, if you just separate the real imaginary parts, so you create a two-n-dimensional real vector, which has unit lengths, then what you're saying when you're requiring these two to be true is that the transformations of that real vector in a two-dimensional Euclidean space are orthogonal transformations, and actually very specific kinds of orthogonal transformations. So you can actually, as it were, combine these two questions into one question and say, well, why are our transformations so special? But that's another way of saying it. I mean, so do you see here you've got a one-to-one map, but over here you would say our transformations are orthogonal transformations of a very special kind.
Mm-hmm. May I make a remark? Mm-hmm. Quantum theory can also be expressed in terms of classical language. There's been this work on geometric quantum mechanics, where you can think of the space of states in the quantum theory as a manifold with this like its structure. I mean, so for me, the only real new thing in quantum theory that has no comparison in the classical framework is measurements. But, I just wanted to make that.
Fair enough. I mean, in that approach, see, the approach takes this, as I was describing, this real vector approach. so that the metric in this space is taken from the Fubini-Studi metric, assumed to be Euclidean metric, and orthogonal transformations are taken as the given, as a starting point. And the symplectic structure is just pulled from quantum theory, and it's not given any physical justification a priori. So yes, you can rewrite quantum theory in that way, but straight away there's still lots of structure there which has no good physical ground. So over the last 10 years or so, last 15 years or so, there's been a great deal of interest in trying to reconstruct the mathematics of quantum theory, starting from some elementary physical ideas. And there are currently around a dozen or so approaches that I'm aware of in the literature. So there's a great deal of kind of excitement and hope that it's actually possible to reduce all of this mathematics here to a set of assumptions which are much more primitive that we can conceptually access. So what I'd like to do now is to get much more specific and just talk about one of the most exciting chapters in Quantum Foundations, and that is to talk about entanglement and the exploration of entanglement, trying to find out what it actually means from a physical point of view. So first of all, just to review, what is entanglement? Entanglement is the idea that I can write down in a quantum formalism states of, say, a bipartite physical system, such as this, which is known as the Bell state, a Bell state, which cannot be factorized. In other words, it can't be written down as a tensor product of the state of system one and the state of system two. So you've got some essential non-separability, which pops up in a quantum formalism. This is not something, again, one sees in classical mechanics. So this is already a feature which is non-trivial and non-classical. Now, one might ask the question, what does this again mean? Because this is a formal feature of the formalism. At this stage, it's just the mathematics. It's saying that I can write down states which can't be factorized. But what does that tell me about the underlying reality? Does that mean that there's some kind of connection between potentially widely separated physical systems that can be used for anything useful? Schrödinger very early on explored those possibilities, or some of those possibilities. For example, he noticed that if Alice and Bob, for example, are two parties that share an entangled state, an entangled Bell state. And we can write this down in this form, where I'm using a basis which is rotated by an angle theta to the z direction. And let's imagine that Alice, far away, makes a measurement in this basis, this rotated basis. And suppose that she gets plus. Then what happens is the state, according to quantum theory, collapses to this product state here. So the state of Bill's particle, the spin state, actually becomes this here. So what Alice has done as a result of doing her measurement is because she has a choice, again, the idea of choice comes in, because she has a choice of which measurement to do, she's able to actually steer Bob's particle to have this particular state, which seems kind of, again, quite interesting. But again, this is formal. The question is, it could be just an artifact of the formalism, and Schrödinger suspected as much. So the question is, can you do anything with this? For example, could Alice actually signal to Bob using this kind of trick? Well, it's not possible, and it's easy to see why. If this is the entangled state, when Alice makes a measurement, she could get plus or minus, in which case Bob becomes either minus theta or plus theta. And let's say he measures in the z direction subsequently. Then there's a probability of him getting up, given that Alice gets plus of that. And likewise, the probability that he gets down, given that Alice gets plus. And you can see that these are certainly dependent upon theta. But when you take into account the fact that he actually doesn't know what Alice got, and you ask the question, okay, so what is the probability of Bob getting up? You find it's just one half. In other words, Alice can't actually, basically Bob's probabilities, outcome probabilities, are independent of Alice's setting. So this work, this scheme won't work. It's not possible for Alice to communicate in this way to Bob. And one can show that this kind of argument holds generally. So I'll now talk about the EPR argument that is another, puts another interesting spin in the story. Einstein here was trying to use something he didn't like, entanglement, to undermine something he really didn't like, which is the indeterminacy of quantum theory. The argument is deceptively simple. So I'll present it quickly. I'm sure all of you know it. So imagine that Alice and Bob share an entangled state, and at time t1, Alice makes a measurement, and let's suppose she gets up. According to quantum theory, the state immediately afterwards is given by up, down. So Bob's particle is in the down state with certainty, and Alice knows this. So what it means is that she can predict with certainty that if Bob makes a measurement over here on his spin in the up direction, in the z direction, he'll get down with certainty. So far, so good. This is just quantum theory. So this is the key point in the EPR argument. They introduce this idea of an element of reality. They say that since that Alice can predict the outcome of Bob's measurement with certainty, there exists an element of reality corresponding to that property, which has the value down. If that sounds fishy, it is. And there's debate even now about whether that definition is sound. We had a lecture from someone just last week saying that it wasn't. But let's just go with it. Let's suppose that there exists an element of reality associated with the spin of Bob's particle in the z direction. So I'm just going to put that element of reality here. And this is the next step in their argument, is to say, well, we're going to assume locality. We're going to assume that Alice's measurement over here and the outcome that she got couldn't possibly have causally brought about the existence of that element of reality. It couldn't have affected its existence. It must have existed even before Alice's measurement. So we can pull it back to here. We know that it must have existed even here. So it's that there was a matter of fact about the world that the spin of Bob's particle in the z direction was actually down, even here. But quantum theory says that Bob's particle had no definite value of spin in this time interval here. So quantum theory must be incomplete. That is to say, the quantum mechanical description, this state here, can't be a complete description of the reality on Bob's side. So that was their conclusion. So you can see there's a stark choice that they present if you agree with their reasoning. If you agree with their reasoning, either it's the case that there is some faster-than-light influence and that Alice's measurement really does bring about the creation of an element of reality on the right-hand side, or you have to conclude that the quantum mechanical description of reality, the state function, is actually incomplete. So this is an argument of logic which sort of makes you wonder, again, whether this entanglement is actually somehow real or not.
Can you make interpretation give a third possibility?
Yes it will. So this argument here is all taking place in one space-time, so we haven't got anything perception splitting or world splitting or anything like that. So the problem with an argument like this being an argument of logic is that one can always just dispute the logic, and this is what Bohr did, for example. So it's very difficult with an argument like this to really have any, to know for sure what to believe. And this is really the great importance of John Bell. What Bell did is to really ask, a brilliant question, which is to ask, well, let's suppose we believe in locality. let's imagine that when Alison Bob, so when these particles were created, they go off to Alison Bob. And let's imagine that any correlations that they find in the data that they obtain when they make measurements is only due to something in the common past. So in other words, only due to something that happened down here. At the outset, we assume that there is no influence that goes faster than light from one side to the other. Let's just assume that. If we do assume that, does that put a constraint on how strong those correlations can be? Or to put it another way around, can in the correlations between the data that they get, can we see the fingerprint of entanglement? Can entanglement allow correlations to be stronger than would be allowed if the world were strictly local? I should explain what's the notation here. So in Bell's setup, I'm modifying it slightly, but the essential idea is that Alice is able to do a Sturm-Gerlach measurement on her side. She chooses one of two directions, that I'm calling them A and A dash. And likewise, Bob can do a Sturm-Gerlach measurement, B or B dash, in two different directions. And in both cases, the data they get is just a sequence of pluses and minuses, plus or minus ones. So let's imagine them doing this experiment thousands of times. So in each case, they get an entangled pair of particles, and at the last moment, they decide whether to measure A dash on this side, B dash on this side, and they record their data. So they actually create a little list of all of their results and what they measured. And then they get together in their forward, in their common future, and they compile a table together. So basically that Alice's measurement, Alice's result, Bob's measurement and Bob's result. And based on this data, they can actually compute four numbers. They can compute the correlation in a case where they get, where they measured A and B. Then they can measure the correlation in the case where they measured A and B dash, and similarly. So basically there are four numbers that they can compute by looking at this table. So they basically reduce all their data to just four numbers. So this is the procedure that one can certainly imagine them doing. So now what we want to do is think of it, say to ourselves, well, all right, let's imagine that the reality is actually local. So as I said, the correlations that they see is only because some common cause in the past. And also make the assumption that when they make the measurements, the measurements that they choose to make aren't causally influenced by whatever that common cause is that generates the correlations. That's to prevent some sort of conspiratorial thing happening. So that's a very mild assumption. And if we do that, it's possible to prove an inequality involving these four numbers. And it's called the Bell-CHSH inequality. Basically, it's a version of Bell's inequality. It generalizes Bell's inequality. And what one finds is the modulus of this linear combination of these expectation values has an upper bound of 2. Okay. And one finds that quantum theory violates this upper bound. Just to illustrate it, if we consider the case where Alice her directions are up and theta, and Bob's directions are up and negative theta, then we get this plot here, where I've got theta and radians here. And the violation is not small, it's huge. It goes to 2.5. The theoretical maximum is 2 square root of 2. And experimental tests seem to bear this out very well. Alan Aspey proposed an experiment in 72, that was published in 84, which showed that this bound of 2 was violated up to 5 standard deviations. So it was a substantial deviation. And since then, other experimental tests have been done that improve upon Aspect experiment in various ways. Certainly there are loopholes, both logical loopholes and experimental loopholes, but the progress that's been made on the logical side has been considerable, and on the experimental side. So it seems increasingly difficult to find a way of evading the idea that there is some real non-locality in nature. But you know, there is still there's certainly room for debate still. So finally, I'd just like to talk about a few recent developments. I talked previously about the idea of reconstructing the quantum formalism. And that being very important because we'd really like to know what are the physical ideas that lie behind this mathematics. One idea that came up in the literature, which is very interesting, is the possibility of kind of turning things around and basically saying, well, look, quantum theory says that there is this entanglement, which seems to allow correlations which can't be explained on a local theory of reality. On the other hand, these correlations aren't strong enough to allow signaling to happen from one side to the other. So there's this curious sense in which quantum theory and the principle of relativity kind of coexist. And so Shimone called this that sort of a peaceful coexistence between these two theories. It's quite remarkable that they managed to just coexist in that way. And this led Popescu and Rolich to propose the idea that maybe we can kind of do an axiomatic reconstruction of quantum theory, much like Einstein's reconstruction of special relativity, by taking non-local correlations and signaling as axioms and see how much of the structure of quantum theory we can get. I mean, in their original attempt, they weren't able to. They showed that these assumptions certainly weren't strong enough to get anywhere near quantum theory. But other people have since developed these ideas in very interesting ways. So I'm just giving this as an example for how, in reconstruction, it's possible to turn things around and say, OK, we're going to take certain properties we know that we feel reasonably confident about that quantum theory has, and actually take those as axiomatic and try to see if we can derive the full structure of quantum theory from that. And the idea is that if you can't do that, then it means that you're missing something. You're missing some physical ingredient, and you can go looking for that ingredient. So it's kind of an iterative process. One of the very interesting developments, somewhat parallel to quantum foundations, has been to say, well, rather than debate whether entanglement and non-locality, so whether non-locality is real or not, is to ask, well, if Alice and Bob actually share entanglement, what can they do with it? Can they do things with it that are somehow genuinely surprising to us? And this has given rise to all sorts of very interesting protocols like teleportation and dense coding and things like entanglement swapping, which you've already heard about. But it's an interesting change of attitude to start actually thinking of entanglement as a resource. And finally, if one takes non-locality as perhaps real, then the question is, well, how do locality and non-locality coexist? On the one hand, we have space, which is supposed to be the stage for all that happens in the world. But on the other hand, you have this non-locality between physical systems, let's suppose. So how do they coexist? How do we understand the coexistence of these two forms of interaction between physical systems? And one way you might proceed is to say, well, maybe we should take non-locality as fundamental. And then locality becomes a thing that we have to explain. There's a good reason for doing it that way, if you want to do it that way, because if you believe that locality rules, then there's no way of getting to non-locality, or no easy way of getting to non-locality. But you could imagine doing it the other way around. So this is an idea that's been, for example, mentioned by Shimone, and is, to some degree, there are some people in quantum gravity are exploring that possible idea. So to conclude, quantum foundations, I think perhaps the most exciting things in recent times are these reconstructive attempts at unlocking the physical content of the quantum formalism. The hope is that if that's achieved, it will be much easier to develop a conception of reality that really takes into account the full richness of the quantum formalism. And as you can see, it's having a pretty profound effect on other areas, such as quantum gravity.
Okay, well, I think that's what we should go for coffee and reconvene at